awareness it does not always associate with action or effectiveness. So just because you're aware, it doesn't mean that you're changing the situation. So I think it's really important to look at how people actually change and what actually has to happen with them psychologically and emotionally for them to be receptive to doing things differently.
Right.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. You're listening to Into the Fold, the Hogg Foundation podcast. Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the Hogg Foundation, our grants, our history, and what it is that we're doing currently in the world of mental health, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Society's awareness of mental health is on an upswing. Here at the Hogg Foundation, we consider that a positive development. We want people to be aware of the importance of mental health to total health. We want people to be aware of societal factors that both threaten mental health and promote it. But there's a case to be made that not all awareness is good, and that audiences can become jaded about awareness campaigns. In a media-saturated culture, it becomes all the more necessary to wield the tools of awareness building thoughtfully and without taking one's audience for granted. Joining me for this conversation are two experts who work at the intersection of communication and public health. Dr. Mike Mackert is director of the Center for Health Communication at the Moody College of Communications at the University of Texas. Carrie Barron, MD, is director of the Creativity for Resilience program and a professor, assistant professor in psychiatry at UT Austin. We are here to have a conversation on media-driven awareness, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Dr. Mackert and Dr. Barron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's good to be here.
Okay, so let's try to frame the conversation. I want to start first with one of the two articles that I hope that you both had a chance to read. The one titled, Stop Raising Awareness Already. Matter of fact, I'm tempted to actually make that the title of this episode, unless someone talks me out of it. First of all, actually, before getting into that, my intro. So when I say that there's a case to be made that not all awareness is good, I mean, does that strike either of you as an overstatement or kind of me putting the thumb on the scale of the conversation?
It seems reasonable enough to me. I mean, in an advertising context, we spend a lot of time trying to start talking to our students about how the goal of an advertising campaign isn't to generate buzz. It's not to get people talking. It is about to get people to buy things. And if you don't train, if you aren't selling things as an advertiser, you are going to be fired from your job. And so I tend to kind of translate that into sort of a mental health or in a health comm context of all awareness. Like, it's not, people being aware isn't good all by itself.
Yeah.
But I think you're right to say that some awareness can be bad awareness if it makes people hold perceptions that aren't accurate, or it kind of creates information that is really hard to dislodge later.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I might say I agree with you, but awareness it does not always associate with action or effectiveness. So just because you're aware, it doesn't mean that you're changing the situation. So I think it's really important to look at how people actually change and what actually has to happen with them psychologically and emotionally for them to be receptive to doing things differently.
Right. And it seems to me that people get as far as the most obvious thing to do when it comes to raising awareness, which is to flood the zone with information. And I think a lot more so than would have been the case when I started here, I just get the sense that there's a level of numbness or perhaps a saturation point that people reach when it comes to novel information that is often absent any meaningful context, and that B, They don't have the time to figure out how to flow into their own day-to-day lives. And so I would imagine surmounting that is a big part of what makes the difference between a good awareness campaign and one that's not so good, right?
Sure. I mean, I think for a lot of big health issues, awareness is definitely not the problem. I mean, I watch, you know, during October when the NFL players all put on their, you know, pink socks and pink everything, and sort of October is just like a pink explosion. Yeah. And every year it's like, are there people who really don't know about breast cancer? Like, how do we, if you were doing work in breast cancer specifically, like how do you translate all of the awareness that I would suspect is relatively common at this point, and how do you start thinking about more effectively taking that awareness and turn it into action of some kind? And so are there key bits of information lots of people don't know yet? Or like, what's the next step is what I always end up thinking about things that are sort of awareness, seem to be primarily awareness campaigns. It's like, but what's next?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also I think that we have to think about the lens that people see through, because, you know, in psychoanalysis, we call it the transference. So we all have a blue plate within us that, a template. And what that means is that you interpret it according to your own life, your own world. And no matter how many facts or how much information you're given, you know, global warming, for example, some people just don't believe in it.
Yeah.
It really has to mesh with your comfort level. And if you don't want to think outside the structure that you've been living in, because that can create anxiety, it might be hard to take in new information.
Right. So getting back to the article, I mean, its basic point is that activists, organizations have a tendency to focus on short-term awareness at the expense of long-term attitude and behavior change. And so I gather that that's probably something that both of you more or less agree with, or that's a hazard of this line of work.
I think it happens in part because when you start thinking about, you know, what's the first thing you want to accomplish, it's raise awareness about your health issue. And I think in some ways that's the easiest thing to do, which is making people aware there is a problem.
Right.
That's easy to get people mm-hmm. in a lot of health issues on board. Like, oh, we do care about breast cancer. We do care about whatever your particular health issue of the day or week or month might be. It's a lot harder to use communication as a tool to change people's behavior. And so I think it's kind of easier in some ways just to keep focusing more on awareness, because that's the somewhere where you can feel like you keep making changes versus getting people to actually change their behavior. That's just harder.
Right, right. I mean, I heard about a campaign. It's called This City's Going on a Diet. I think it was in Oklahoma, where they actually got people to lose 1 million pounds. The city in general lost 1 million pounds. So, but that was unusual because the campaign was able to actually change behavior and motivate people. So I think there's something in there to understand.
I bet.
Yeah, yeah. So how did they do that? I think it also has to do with what your neighbor is doing can have a lot of influence over you, and you can motivate each other.
Right.
Let's take a walk tonight and eat healthy together.
Right.
So
I just heard an interview with the mayor of Oklahoma City.
Oh, you did?
He was talking about how he kept hearing, I think it was Men's Fitness had an article that was like, you know, that he knew Oklahoma City was growing when they started making like top 10 lists.
Yeah.
And one of the ones they made was like the top 10 most obese cities.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really offended on behalf of his city. And then he went to go look at what being obese means according to like the government. And he was like, well, that's awfully rude because I'm not obese.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and then he had this long internal process of like, oh, I kind of am. And then he turned that into, I just don't want to lose weight for myself. I want our city to lose 1 million pounds. And something like 5 years later, they had risen on the same magazine's list of the top 10 fittest cities.
So great.
In the country.
So great.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I don't really know what the mental health analog to that would be, unfortunately. And one of the things that I try to make an effort at doing here at Hogg Foundation is, like, for example, for something as quotidian as stock imagery. You know, you've seen what a stock depression image looks like. You know, the classic head clutcher pose. I mean, it's, you want something that's evocative, but that also doesn't reinforce stigma and stereotypes. But problem is that so much of what's memorable to people is kind of negative, isn't it? And so that kind of segues me to the other article, you know, the one from The Conversation, how much power can an image actually wield? And you see, it seems like when it comes to some issues, there's almost a potent imagery arms race that goes on. You know, whether it's cancer, you know, whether it's, I mean, anti-smoking campaigns, I think, are pretty famous for this. And everything is kind of dark-hued, and, you know, this is what might happen to you unless you quit. But to boil down what the article says, that most people assume that potent, emotionally charged imagery plays some role in building awareness. And yet research suggests that that only happens in some cases, or for a limited period of time. So when it comes to mental illness, again, there's a rich history of gut-punching imagery being used to evoke despair, isolation, psychic disintegration. So my question is, I mean, is there any thinking out there about how it is that, you know, the people in our field can be more strategic about image choice?
Well, I think sometimes people can get inured to images if they're too strong, too graphic, and too dramatic. So that can sort of turn off the compassion. So I think maybe what you're trying to elicit is compassion.
Yeah.
But I think it's...
Or sex ed. That might even be a better example than any smoking.
Well, so I would... Texting while driving is what often comes to mind for me in terms of evocative images and such. Because there's all these campaigns that get sometimes a ton of traction because it's the most well-shot graphic representation of an accident because some person was texting. And I think it makes people quit texting while driving for about 3 minutes. And then they're like, well, I'm better than the person in that ad at texting while driving. And I mean, I've had students do...
I know I am.
Yeah. I mean, and so I've had students, we actually did a project with the Texas Department of Transportation around texting while driving. And they all had their various things. And at the end, the client said, asked the students, he's like, would any of these things like honestly work on you guys? And one of my students raises his hand. He's like, I texted while driving on the way to make the presentation today. He's like,
oh, wow.
Because that is to them such a hard ask in terms of behavior change.
Yeah.
The images, even if they're evocative in the moment, don't promote long-term behavior change. And so I think to your point, it's not so much an evocative image of any kind. Like, sure, it can cut through the clutter, but like, what's the payoff? What's the next step? What are you asking people to do that's different or meaningful in some way? Because if you don't capitalize on that with a thing that's easy to do, it's just not going to go anywhere.
It might be that if the imagery could show development, you know, instead of just showing depression, maybe it can show that, you know, you move from a dark place to a lighter place. Because I think for depressed people, it can be very, very hard to know that you can be out of this, that you can feel better. It's hard to imagine sort of a lighter, happier existence. It's very hard to see it.
Yeah.
So maybe imagery can help that person understand there's a way to get there.
Yeah.
So both of them, you know, point A to point B.
Right. That's a wonderful example.
We had this idea years ago. We've just never managed to have the time or capacity to produce it. But for texting while driving specifically, there's all these, again, fear appeals around that. And to what you say, like, you're doing it because you're making sure you text someone that you're on your way home and you're not gonna get yelled at for being late. I bet if you saw the person in the car next to you texting while driving, while you're doing that, you're going to think they're a jerk for texting while driving.
Yeah.
And so for a long time, we had had the idea for a campaign that would be something like, someone else thinks you're the jerk right now, or something that would kind of make that a very like a recognition or reminder of like how other people look at you in your car when you're texting while driving, even if your reason is really good. I have no idea if that would actually change behavior or not, but it's something that doesn't seem to have been tried yet.
That's cool.
And seems more like, to me, more potentially possible to work than just like yet another fear appeal.
Yeah, that's interesting. But also I think of it as competing moralities, right? So there's the morality of obeying that law about not texting while driving, but then there is your loyalty to your your mate or your spouse, or, you know, that conscientiousness of letting someone know that you're going to be late. So
yeah. I'm a nice, thoughtful person when I'm texting while driving.
Yeah.
So I try to split the difference by trying to be a little bit understanding of all the different ways that people can be caught up, because there are things about modern life that drive people to various kinds of madness in a way.
Mm-hmm.
That the individual only has so much ability on their own to push back against. And so, I mean, even so, it seems that, you know, so much of the conversation when it comes to stuff like this, you know, relies upon, you know, kind of particularly egregious examples of the behavior. You know, some particular individual screws up in a particular way, the story goes viral, and that one person ends up being pilloried, you know? And I try to hold back from that as much as possible, at least intellectually. As much fun as, you know, a good lynch mob can be. You know, some particular example of somebody texting while driving leading to the most horrific imaginable end. I'm always saying to myself, this person can't be that much different from me, you know? Certainly not more distracted, you know, certainly not more prone to letting their attention be diverted. And it's a little scary. There, but for the grace of God.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
That was in my head too.
Yeah.
So I think very much in terms of solidarity as much as I can. And I think, you know, that people who have a clue about public health certainly have an incumbent responsibility to give people the tools that they need to make the right choices,
right?
Mm-hmm. And that even goes with, you know, at the very least, not adding to all of the noise that's out there.
You know, I recall that when I was young, there was this campaign, please, please don't be a litter bug. And as I recall, it worked. People stopped throwing garbage out of their car windows. And I remember as a child being very conscious not to do that, not to, you know, to be very aware of garbage or.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it worked, but.
Well, it was because that's not a hard ask, right? I mean, you're like, don't throw your stuff out of your car. Like, hold on to it for 10 minutes until you get home. Like, you're not asking people to make a ridiculous behavior change. I mean, we spend a lot of time thinking about kind of what's a reasonable goal for a communication campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I heard I think it was the founder of Mothers Against Drunk Driving talking, and she is of the firm belief that texting while driving is on the exact same trajectory that drunk driving was, you know, 20 years ago, where you try all these communication solutions, like don't go drunk driving, like all the things, and communication doesn't change that behavior. And it's, you crash your car while you're drunk and we're going to take your license away. Like, it's a policy. Like, it's also made a policy change, not a communication effort. And to her, she said that she just sees the texting while driving thing hitting kind of every single note
mm-hmm.
that the drunk driving thing did, you know, 2-3 decades ago. Just, it's like, you try all these communication things because you don't want to be like a nanny state forcing people to do X, Y, and Z. But eventually, like, that's kind of what it takes to change some of these behaviors.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm. Right. I also think sometimes people want to be a little daring in secret or rebellious in secret, you know, that they, or like what you said, that was very interesting, that they think, well, it doesn't apply to me because I'm very careful. I wouldn't get into an accident because I know how to text and drive. Yeah. I mean, there's a little bit of a elevated self-image there.
Lake will be gone. Everyone's a little bit above average, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that even used to be a thing with seatbelts, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so interesting because... And I'm fascinated by all this kind of stuff, you know. It's like, because our behavior really is so regimented in a lot of respects, you know, we do what we're supposed to do the vast majority of the time. We show up where we're supposed to show up. We follow the rules. those small acts of rebellion that you allude to can become so significant, you know, for people. It's always interesting to me, the hills that people choose to die on, you know, whether it's, you know, not wearing a helmet while being on a motorcycle, or, you know, back in the day, not wearing a seatbelt. I mean, that I remember that being a thing, particularly for people like above a certain age. I just remember that being a thing.
Well, and I go to the kind of the communication piece of like, how do you get people to change their behavior and think about just alternative ways of doing that? Like, you brought up seatbelts. I still remember, I hear my mom and dad laugh about it more, but apparently my school must have been part of some kind of communication, public health intervention around seatbelt usage, because when I was in second grade, I was trained by my teacher, and I'm sure my entire class was, that like, not only should you have your seatbelt on before your car starts moving, your parents should too. And so I was turned into this like very annoying seatbelt advocate in the back seat, in that like I would start hollering if like the car was turned on even before all the seatbelts were done. So my parents this day laugh about the fact that I had become like this little parking, you know, seatbelt person. But like, I don't know what the equivalent of is for kind of mental health, but how we can maybe more effectively use kids as agents of change to help change their parents' behavior before some of those negative images you talked about have already been set in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because maybe they're more receptive
right
to these kinds of campaigns. That's interesting. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So before I let you two go, so I didn't come to you both just for opinions, but just any advice that you have to give. I am not a mental health expert by any stretch of the imagination. Everything I know about it, I've kind of learned through osmosis. And so as much as possible, I'm always asking people, you know, what have you heard about this issue? What do you think is not getting out there? That's sort of beyond what it is that you imagine is getting out there. Is there any particular kind of mental health related message, idea, trope that you think merits some amplification?
I have one that I think is very, very important. You know, it's very, very normal to feel anxious and depressed sometimes. And we're really all on a spectrum. I mean, there is nobody, I would say, who doesn't feel that sometimes. And it's very important, I think, to have a strengths-based orientation as well. And no matter what your illness, there are always beautiful, wonderful strengths that you have and things that can be developed. So that would be my comment.
That is a very challenging act to follow. I am not a mental health expert. I dabble in lots of health issues. I think the piece of advice or thought that I share that I do at lots of health and public health sort of conferences is the degree to which I'm going to wager that almost everyone listening to this podcast cares deeply about mental health. And while that makes them all wonderful people, it also makes them quite unusual in that they care enough about mental health to listen to this podcast. Yeah. And so I think one of the hardest things to do in communication is sort of take 3 or 4 steps backwards and go back to thinking about what is it like to be sort of the average person and what they think about this health issue. And so if you're going to develop messages that work on sort of the general public or the average person, being able to separate yourself from this issue you care a lot about is a really hard thing to pull off. And it's kind of a skill that comes with practice over time. But I think that's kind of one of the things that can be trickiest when you think about how do you go beyond an awareness campaign is, what was it like before I cared so much about this that I was talking about? Like, what's it like to be that person again?
Yeah.
Because then you have to reach that person where they are and how you get them where you actually want them to go.
All right. Dr. Mackert, Dr. Barron, thank you so much for being willing to listen to my digressions and so forth and to help me give them some point. So I thank you very much for coming here and sharing your wisdom with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. It was a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
It was really great to be here.